Coming up is the news.
U.S. President Joe Biden proposes a five-year extension with Russia of the New START, that's the last remaining nuclear reduction treaty between the two countries. Meanwhile, Iran's foreign minister warns new U.S. President Joe Biden of Israeli plots to push Washington into confrontation with the Islamic Republic. And Iraqis hold a funeral for victims of Thursday's deadly twin bomb attacks in the capital of Baghdad, claimed by Daesh terrorists. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. U.S. says it is seeking to extend the New START, that's the last remaining arms control treaty with Russia. New U.S. President Joe Biden has proposed to extend the 2010 New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty for another 5 years, but he pledged to pressure Moscow on other fronts. Russia had earlier offered to extend the treaty by 5 years, but former U.S. administration refused the proposal and offered a short-term extension, which Moscow rejected. Now, the treaty, which limits the U.S. and Russia to 1,550 nuclear warheads each, expires February 5th. Political commentator Vladimir Goldstein says both Russia and the U.S., despite the rhetoric, will like to extend the New START treaty.
Well, you know, it's just more or less a gesture of goodwill. It was expected. Many analysts on both sides understood that it's pretty beneficial for both countries. You know, nobody needs a very, intense arms race at that moment when economies or each country is not doing particularly well, and each country has a lot on their plate. So that's what's kind of more or less logical. It's, you know, just a rather stubborn Trump administration decided to sort of reconsider that because, as Allison said, that they wanted to China to be involved, and China said we don't want to be involved because we have less. And there was other issues of verification, but it stood to reason. However, you know, that was like a Trump's attitude of not respecting any treaties done before him. Now we have a new president, Biden, who does want to respect the attitudes of Trump. So I think it makes sense. It made perfect sense.
The U.S. House of Representatives will reportedly send an impeachment charge accusing former President Donald Trump of inciting insurrection to the Senate as early as Friday. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi rejected Republican demands to back away from impeachment. She emphasized the House is ready to begin the trial, but did not say when she'll send the impeachment article to the Senate. The Democrats are narrowly in control of the Senate, but at least two-thirds of the 100-member body is required to convict Donald Trump. And if convicted, a separate vote will then be taken to decide whether to block him from seeking presidency again. Some Senate Republicans have argued that Congress should not put a former president on trial. U.S. President Joe Biden has warned the worst of the coronavirus pandemic is yet to come for Americans.
Let me be very clear. Things are going to continue to get worse before they get better. The memorial we held 2 nights ago will not be our last one, unfortunately. The death toll will likely top 500,000 next month. The cases will continue to mount. We didn't get into this mess overnight. It's going to take months for us to turn things around. Let me be equally
clear. On his first full day as president, Biden painted a bleak picture of the country's coronavirus battle, criticizing the former administration for the situation. He said that the federal government had failed to act with the necessary urgency focus and coordination over the past year, inflicting a tragic cost. The president added that rollout of vaccines has been a dismal failure. He also noted the pandemic has disproportionately impacted Blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans. Biden signed a series of executive orders aimed at addressing the pandemic, which has already claimed more than 409,000 American lives and infected over 24.5 million people in the U.S. So as Joe Biden is taking over the White House, many are asking what changes will be made to America's foreign policy, in particular in the war in Yemen. Trump's terrorist designation of Yemen's Ansarullah and continued U.S. support for Saudi-led aggression have both hampered peace efforts.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former U.S. President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for. And you would see it in the near future. Is something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions? So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that, and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances. And our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new US President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over. They stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop, and Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the U.S. ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansarullah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's foreign minister warns a new U.S. President Joe Biden of an Israeli plot to push Washington into confrontation with the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the Israeli prime minister is aiming to trap another U.S. president into spending American blood and money to confront Iran. Zarif also lambasted Benjamin Netanyahu's congratulatory message to Biden, in which he urged a newly sworn-in president to work with Israel to confront what he called the Iran threat. Zarif called the message bootlicking and cringeworthy, stressing such desperate plotting against Iran will fail. Israel's call for an anti-Iranian stance follows Biden's remarks about a conditional return to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Now, Iraqis have held a funeral for victims of a twin bomb attack in the capital, Baghdad. Mourners carrying coffins of victims toward a cemetery for burial. Two male bombers blew themselves up at a crowded Baghdad market. Explosions killed at least 32 people and wounded 110 others. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. And reactions are pouring in over Thursday's twin bomb attacks, which killed over 30 people in Baghdad. The Iraqi president, Barham Saleh, condemned the bombing, saying his country stands firmly against rogue attempts to destabilize it. The Prime Minister, Mustafa Al-Khadimi, stressed the country will never rest until it's free of terrorism. Country's top Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, urged security officials to step up the fight against those who want to harm people. Also, Iran's foreign ministry strongly condemned the attack, saying the country stands ready to give Iraq any assistance and it needs to fight terrorism. In Lebanon, the resistance movement Hezbollah deplored the bombings as vicious. It said the return of such attacks is suspicious at a time when calls are growing in Iraq for the expulsion of U.S. forces. Political commentator Ali Nashmi says the Daesh terrorist group is making a resurgence in the country thanks to U.S.-Israeli efforts to weaken the country's popular mobilization units.
There is many injured, more than 100, and the martyrs is more than 30. And no one declared till now about who's behind it. But I think there is many wings or many directions behind that, and especially now the ISILs increasing their action in the Iraq, especially in this period when the government and the Western and American and Israel, they targeted the popular mobilization and the people now shouting against them, and they listen for this media against the popular mobilization. And there is a policy now from 6 months to reducing or to weakening popular mobilization. Then they used that kind of weakening and they escaped and come in the central of Baghdad and using the explosive belt.
The Islamic Human Rights Commission has urged the Nigerian president to release top cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki and his wife over their deteriorating health. Group made a call in a letter to Muhammad Buhari after the cleric's wife Zinat tested positive for the coronavirus. The couple are currently in prison in Kaduna State Jail. The NGO also asked the UN to pressure the Nigerian government to immediately release the sheikh and his wife. Two have been in jail since the Nigerian army attacked their residence in the northern city of Zaria 5 years ago. Hundreds of Sheikh Zakzaki supporters were killed in the raid and many others arrested. Despite a high court ruling for his release, though, the cleric remains in custody as part of a government crackdown on his Islamic movement in Nigeria. Political commentator Masoud Shajada says the imprisonment of Sheikh Zakzaki and his wife is an outrageous act by Nigeria's government and it's also against international law.
The reality is that under the international law and indeed Nigerian law, someone who is who's ill to the extent that the health condition of both of them under the current pandemic should be at least put somewhere safe. I mean, the fact that someone has actually is already been shown positive should be taken to hospital. We are not saying to overlook the legal due process. What we are saying, the legal due process needs to be implemented. Hmm. And indeed, they should be now taken to a safe place, i.e. a medical facility, so they will be able to, to be able to get remedy. What seems to be very clearly, and I say this because I can't see any other excuses except that they really want to endanger their lives and they want to actually, by dragging their feet, to sort of create the environment where both Sheikhs and his wife are in danger of actually dying. And it seems that that is the only explanation. And that is really is outrageous.
Israel plans to build 2,500 new settler units in the occupied West Bank and has drawn condemnations from the Muslim world. The Arab League slammed Israel for its disregard for international calls to end construction of settlements, called on the international community and the UN Security Council to take measures to put a stop to the illegal activities. The Organization of Islamic Cooperation also denounced the move as a continuation of the regime's violations of international resolutions. It added that such decisions are made to undermine the outlook for a solution to the Palestinian issue. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. And Bruce Katz, human rights activist, earlier joined us saying the Arab states have normalized relations with Israel, have effectively endorsed the regime's expansionism.
Statements by the Arab League and the Islamic Organization of Cooperation should be taken with a grain of salt, because when you look at a number of the countries that are their members, and I refer to countries like Bahrain, Egypt, Morocco, Oman, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. These are all countries that are have normalized with Israel, and therefore they support the apartheid state, and as such, they give a green light to exactly what is happening with the expansion of settlements being done with impunity. So from the point of view of Arab countries, of certain Arab countries that have continuously stabbed the Palestinians in the back, there's nothing much to be expected from them except words that float in the air and which are basically meant to keep their populations from being too critical. It's really just mere posturing.
Paris says it will not apologize for atrocities committed by French forces in Algeria during the colonization of the North African nation. President Emmanuel Macron says he will instead commemorate his country's colonial past in three ceremonies organized by the government.
French President Emmanuel Macron has rolled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposal to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration, since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as proof of Kouchner's remark that the French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war on Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
What you heard
was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Researchers are studying the sensory impact of the coronavirus, how long it lasts, and what can be done to treat it. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Michael Marshall Ryder. This article is published under the heading COVID's Toll on Smell and Taste, What Scientists Do and Don't Know. Here's the details. Early in the COVID-19 pandemic, it emerged that many people infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus were losing their sense of smell, even without displaying other symptoms. Researchers also discovered that infected people could lose their sense of taste and their ability to detect chemically triggered sensations such as spiciness called chemitesis. Almost a year later, some still haven't recovered these senses, and for a proportion of people who have, odors are now warped. Unpleasant scents have taken the place of normally delightful ones. Nature surveys the science behind this potentially long-lasting and debilitating phenomena. How many people with COVID-19 lose their sense of smell? The exact percentage varies between studies, but most suggest that a smell loss is a common symptom. One review published last June compiled data from 8,438 people with COVID-19 and found that 41% had reported experiencing smell loss. In another study published in August 2nd, a team led by researcher Shimati Moen at Institute for Research in Fundamental Sciences in Tehran, Iran, administered a smell identification to 100 people with COVID-19, in which the patients sniffed odors and identified them on a multiple choice basis. 96% of the participants had some olfactory dysfunction, and 18% had total smell loss, otherwise known as anosmia. Usually, these patients say they have lost their smell suddenly, a clue that the symptom is linked to COVID-19, says Moin. And often, the dysfunction is the only COVID-19 symptom that people register, suggesting that the phenomenon is separate from the virus-induced nasal congestion. Some researchers say smell loss should be used as a diagnostic test for COVID-19. A study published last October found that self-reported changes in smell and taste were a better marker of the spread of infection than were other indicators tracked by governments, such as arrivals at hospital, accident, and emergency departments. Why do people with COVID-19 lose their sensitivity to smells? Although the mechanisms are not fully understood, there is an emerging consensus that the smell loss occurs when the coronavirus infects cells that support neurons in the nose. When researchers first identified smellless as a symptom of COVID-19, they were worried that the virus was infecting the odor-sensing neurons in the nose that send signals to the olfactory bulb in the brain, and that the virus could therefore access the brain. However, the post-mortem studies of people who had COVID-19 have shown that the virus rarely reaches the brain. A team led by Sandeep Robertadatta, a neurobiologist at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts, has instead found cells that support sensory neurons in the nose, known as sustentacular cells, are probably what the virus is infecting. Datta and his colleagues zeroed in on sustentacular because SARS-CoV attacks by targeting a receptor called ACE2 on the surface of cells, and sustentacular cells have many such receptors. Olfactory sensory neurons do not. This suggests that the coronavirus infects the support cells, leaving the neurons vulnerable and deprived of nutrients. But there might be other ways in which COVID-19 induces smell loss. For instance, a research team in Italy showed smell and taste loss occur at the same time as an increase in blood levels of an inflammation signaling molecule called interleukin 6. And a post-mortem study published last December showed clear signs of inflammation, such as leaky blood vessels in the olfactory bulbs of people who had had COVID-19. Although scientists have some understanding of the mechanisms involved in the smell, they have little idea about how the coronavirus affects taste and chemisynthesis. Nobody has a good handle on that yet, I know of, says John Hayes, a food scientist at Pennsylvania State University in University Park, who is studying COVID-19 effect on chemical senses. Taste and chemisynthesis are senses that are distinct from smell, even though all three combine to tell humans what flavor a food or beverage has. Taste relies mainly on taste receptors on the tongue, whereas chemisynthesis relies on ion channels on sensory nerves. Among other mechanisms, and the response to COVID-19 has not been studied much. And how quickly do the impaired senses return? For most people, smell, taste, and chemisynthesis recover within weeks. In a study published last July, 72% of people with COVID-19 who had olfactory dysfunction reported that they recovered their sense of smell after a month, as did 84% of people with taste dysfunction. Claire Hopkins, an ear, nose, and throat consultant at Guy's and St. Thomas Hospital in London, and her colleagues similarly observed the speedy return of the senses. They followed 202 patients for a month and found that 49% reported complete recovery over that time, and a further 41% reported an improvement. And how does permanently losing the chemical senses affect a person? Although the condition is not as well studied as the loss of other senses such as vision and hearing, researchers know that the consequences can be severe. One effect is that it leaves people vulnerable to dangers such as food poisoning and fire. For instance, people with anosmia are less able to detect spoiled foods and smoke. A 2014 study found that people with anosmia were more than twice as likely to experience a hazardous event, such as eating spoiled food, as people without a smell loss. other effects are more difficult to measure. Most people don't acknowledge the importance of a smell in their lives until they lose it, says Moyne. Being unable to appreciate the flavor of food is obviously a major loss, but other sensations are important too. Hayes points, for instance, to the loss a parent would feel if they couldn't connect to their child through the newborn baby smell. And Moyne says that smell dysfunction has been linked with depression, although the biological mechanism involved is unclear. Are treatments available for restoring these senses? A lack of research means few established treatments exist. But one option is a smell training, in which people sniff prescribed odors regularly to learn them. Hopkins is working with a charity called Absent in Andover, UK, to get the word out to the public about this training. There is evidence from before the pandemic that is, it can improve smell function in some people with such impairments, but it doesn't seem to work for everyone. Available drugs are even more limited, says Hopkins. But for the people in the early stages of COVID-19 infection, when a smell loss might be largely due to inflammation of nose cells, esters might be helpful, according to a preliminary trial carried out by Hopkins' team. In longer-term research, Richard Costanzo and Daniel Coleo at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond are developing an olfactory implant, a device embedded in the nose that would sense odorant chemicals and send electrical signals to the brain. However, the device is still many years from being offered in clinics, says Coleo. In particular, the researchers need to figure out which areas of the brain the implant should stimulate, he adds, so there is still some science to work out.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Axel Djawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Djawadi Amuli. The systematic kind of approach that Islam has on how we are able to conduct ourselves, how we are able to not only preserve our lives as human beings and flourish in this world, but also make sure that we are working towards what's going to benefit us in the hereafter, ultimately, but also what's going to give us that kind of sa'ada dunyawiya, this a pleasurable, positive, good, happy life. And what I mean by a systematic kind of approach is that it's catering for all of these different things all at once, and that's what's so unique and so special about our religion, Islam. And Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli makes it very clear in the beginning of chapter 5, where he wants to discuss cleanliness and hygiene. And he says that Islam is based on three foundations. So there are three pivotal kind of centralized elements in Islam. The first is your belief system. The second is your moral system. The third is your legal system. Your aqidah, your aqaid, your belief, your ideological kind of understanding of things, which is based on and centralized on tawheed, is something that will enable you to have the best kind of intellectual, rational lifestyle, and it will keep you away from any kind of pollution of shirk, of polytheism, or anything else that will, you know, put your rational kind of understanding on hold, or that will remove your aqli capacity to conduct yourself, to live as a human being. And that's why Islam is a reason first religion. So your aql and ta'aql comes first, and then everything else. You know, it's a reason based religion. It's not a faith based religion.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Reason-based, because anything else will pollute you as a human being. You know, if you turn towards idol worshipping, or if you turn towards something that is irrational, how is that going to justify your religious kind of understanding of things? How is that going to justify your rational approach, your intellect? God created you with aql. And for you to put it on hold, for you to put it on the side, for you to say, no, I'm not going to use it, it's not going to be the fundamental foundation of my belief system, you know, that is the worst kind of betrayal, let alone it turning to something like ilhad or atheism or kufr or disbelief, you know. And that's why your tawhidi, monotheistic belief will keep you pure from all of these things. Then we look at akhlaq. And akhlaq and your ethics, your morality, and the moral system, the moral compass that you have, will keep you pure from any kind of oppression, any kind of tyranny. Oppression of your nafs, oppression towards your nafs, oppression towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or oppression towards others. That's the kind of three-way pyramid that we have, that you could do dhulm to God, you could do dhulm to yourself, you could do dhulm to others. Of course, the fourth one is you could do dhulm to an oppression to nature. But akhlaq keeps you intact as far as keeping you pure from any of these kind of oppression and dhulm as far as these vices or degenerate things are concerned. As for ahkam, as for your rules, the regulations, the legal side of Islam, the sharia, whatever it may be, it keeps you pure from any kind of inappropriate behavior. Inappropriate behavior towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, inappropriate behavior towards yourself, inappropriate behavior towards others. You know, it keeps you pure from any of these bad kind of behavioral attitudes that are always going to be wrong. And that's why a religious person has these three foundations a part of his or her identity. The aqidah side and keeping yourself pure, the akhlaq side and keeping yourself pure, the ahkam side and keeping yourself pure. Sheikh Jawadi Amali then mentions a verse from the Holy Quran, and he says, Surah Al-Taghabun, ayah number 16, فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ مَسْتَطَعْتُمْ, and make sure that you are wary of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as much as you are able to. And then he says that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi comments on this ayah, and he says, تَنَظَّفُوا بِكُلِّ مَسْتَطَعْتُمْ, keep yourself clean as much as you are able to. Be wary of God. Have taqwa in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as much as you are able to. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made his most definitive break yet with President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 19th of January, while the leader of the incoming Democratic majority laid out an ambitious agenda for the opening weeks of the Biden administration, signaling a dizzying changing of the guard in Washington. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalists Mike DeBonis and Paul Kane. The piece is titled "Uncertainty Reigns in Senate as Schumer Pushes Past Agenda and McConnell Calls Out Trump." Stay with us for more of Mike DeBonis and Paul Kane's article. Outgoing Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made his most definitive break yet with President Donald Trump on Tuesday, 19th of January, while the leader of the incoming Democratic majority laid out an ambitious agenda for the opening weeks of the Biden administration, signaling a dizzying changing of the guards in Washington. Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, for the first time directly blamed Donald Trump for the lethal 6th of January assault on the Capitol. "The mob was fed lies," he said in his final floor speech, closing out 6 years as majority leader. "They were provoked by the president and other powerful people." Senator Charles Schumer, a Democrat from New York, outlined a rapid-fire agenda for the coming weeks that includes confirming Joe Biden's cabinet nominees, approving trillions of dollars in additional pandemic aid, and barring Trump from holding office, despite an uncertain roadmap in the 50-50 Senate, which is struggling even to adopt its basic rules. Senator Charles Schumer is set to move from minority leader to majority leader on Wednesday, when the Senate meets shortly after the inauguration of Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, who will tip the chamber towards Democrats with her tie-breaking vote. "The next several months will be very, very busy and a very consequential period for the United States Senate," Schumer said on the Senate floor. "Let us begin our work in earnest." Significant obstacles threaten each of Schumer's early goals. Republicans have thrown up early roadblocks to some of Joe Biden's key nominees. GOP fiscal concerns could make a bipartisan coronavirus bill difficult to pass, and Trump's impeachment trial threatens to consume the earliest days of the Senate Democratic majority. Beyond that, Schumer and McConnell reached an impasse on Tuesday, 19th of January, in talks to set the open operating rules of the equally divided Senate, making any action a challenge. As Mitch McConnell demanded that Democrats drop any notion of ending the legislative filibuster, McConnell also seized the opportunity to make at least a rhetorical break with Donald Trump at a moment when the consequences are relatively low, with Trump leaving office and the benefits potentially high, possibly winning back donors turned off by Donald Trump's actions. Most of Mitch McConnell's fellow Senate Republicans, however, showed little sign of following suit. Many must still contend with a GOP base that is supportive of Trump, and they could pay a price for denouncing him too forcefully, suggesting the party could face a years-long struggle between those embracing Trump and those distancing themselves. It would take two-thirds of the Senate to convict Donald Trump and bar him from future office. So Republican senators would need to supply 17 votes if all Democrats vote against Trump. Even McConnell did not say whether Trump should be convicted. Senator Joni Ernst, a Republican from Iowa, a member of Mitch McConnell's leadership team who just secured a second six-year term, joined a growing group of Republicans arguing that it would be unconstitutional to try Donald Trump after he leaves office, a position that is challenged by some constitutional scholars, but embraced by GOP office holders as they struggle to square Trump's conduct with his popularity among Republican voters. "He's not our president after tomorrow," Senator Joni Ernst said, accusing Democrats of wanting to further divide the nation with a Senate trial. "We need to start healing. I don't think this does that." Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina, who has been among a small group of Republicans counseling Donald Trump since the 6th of January riot, said convicting Trump after he leaves the presidency is bad for the presidency and it's bad for the country. But Senator Schumer said Trump's actions, which included repeating baseless claims of a stolen election, calling his supporters to gather in Washington on the day of the electoral vote certification, and then sending them towards the Capitol building as the proceedings got underway, deserved the gravest possible reprimand under America's Constitution. After what he has done, the consequences of which we're all witness to, Donald Trump should not be eligible to run for office ever again, Charles Schumer said. "All of us want to put this awful chapter in our nation's history behind us, but healing and unity will only come if there is truth and accountability, not sweeping such a severe charge and such awful actions under the rug." The push for accountability could impinge on the other items on the Democratic to-do list. A presidential impeachment trial has historically been an all-consuming affair for the Senate, impeding virtually all other significant business, and previous trials have lasted several weeks. Donald Trump's first trial in the Senate concluded last February and lasted for 21 days. While some Democratic senators have floated a much shorter trial this time around, the House impeachment managers who act as prosecutors could feel compelled to present witnesses and evidence elucidating the president's role in the violence, as well as legal arguments rebutting the claim that former officials cannot be convicted. The impeachment resolution passed last week in the House of Representatives holds that Trump warrants disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, language found in the Constitution relating to those who foster insurrection. Senator Richard Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, the number two Democratic leader, said balancing the trial with the other pillars of the Biden agenda would depend on a level of cooperation with Republicans. "We need to get President Biden, his team," he said. "America is in a terrible situation with this pandemic. We have issues of national security that are still in front of us. We have an economy that's struggling. All of those things are high priorities." Looming over all of the incoming business in the Senate is the unfinished negotiation between Mitch McConnell and Charles Schumer about precisely how a 50-50 Senate will operate. Both leaders are eyeing the rules from the last evenly split Senate in 2001 as a template. Republicans and Democrats agreed then that the party holding the White House, and therefore the vice presidency, would set the floor agenda and chair committees, while the panels themselves would be evenly split. Mitch McConnell, however, threw a new wrinkle into the negotiations, seeking assurances from Schumer that Democrats would swear off any attempt at abolishing the 60-vote threshold for cutting off debate on legislation, something liberal activists have been demanding for years. McConnell's spokesman, Doug Andreas, confirmed the filibuster demand remains an unsettled issue. Discussions on all aspects of the power-sharing agreement will continue over the next several days, he said. Charles Schumer's spokesman, Justin Goodman, said the Democratic leader's view is that the fairest, most reasonable, and easiest path forward is to adopt the 2001 bipartisan agreement without extraneous changes from either side. Mitch McConnell and Charles Schumer emerged from a 30-minute meeting reporting no real progress, and some advisers suggested no deal could be struck this week. The impasse, according to multiple Senate aides, could mean that Joe Biden finishes at least his first day in office without any cabinet members being confirmed, a highly unusual circumstance in recent history. Speaking on the floor on Tuesday, 19th of January, Mitch McConnell sent a signal to Democrats by asserting that Joe Biden enters office without a mandate for sweeping ideological change, given the narrow majorities in the House and the Senate, and Biden's platform as a presidential candidate who said he'd represent everyone. Until negotiations over the Senate procedures are resolved, many of Joe Biden's cabinet selections could linger in limbo. Committees will be unable to formally process nominees and send them to the full Senate, and the only path for a nominee would be if all 100 senators agreed to move the selection directly onto the Senate floor. Several Senate committees held hearings on Tuesday, 19th of January, with Biden nominees, including his picks to lead the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, Department of State, and Treasury, as well as his choice for Director of National Intelligence. One roadblock emerged on Tuesday from Republican Senator Josh Hawley, who announced he would object to any effort to advance Alejandro N. Mayorkas, Joe Biden's pick for Homeland Security Secretary, to the Senate floor. In a statement, Josh Hawley cited Biden's immigration platform, which includes creating a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants. Mr. Mayorkas has not adequately explained how he will enforce federal laws and secure the southern border, given President-elect Joe Biden's promise to roll back major enforcement and security measures, said Hawley, who came under fire for contesting the Electoral College count even after the mob ransacked the Capitol building. Meanwhile, the incoming chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Robert Menendez, a Democrat from New Jersey, said Anthony Blinken, Joe Biden's nominee for Secretary of State, would not get a panel vote until next week. And Senate action on Joe Biden's choice for Defense Secretary, retired General Lloyd Austin, is in limbo due to the need for a congressional waiver of the federal law requiring that former military officials must wait at least 7 years before they can become defense secretary. Some Senate aides on Tuesday expressed hope that Janet Yellen, Joe Biden's nominee for Treasury Secretary, and Avril Haines, Biden's nominee for Director of National Intelligence, could win confirmation on Wednesday.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.